FW Presents, Panel by Panel, the show that dissects a single comic book panel from the last 85 years of comics history, each episode. I'm Siskoid, and our panelist today, making his first appearance on a podcast anywhere, I think it's anywhere, is Brian Linton. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you. Yes, it is anywhere. This is my first, my maiden voyage into the great ocean that is the world of podcasting.
At least the water. Be careful of the fire, but embrace the water. So I'm happy to give you your first shot, your audition. This is your audition tape, but don't feel nervous.
I do, but I'll pretend not to.
It's just a simple conversation. And the way that panel by panel works, of course, is that we use a randomized series of choices using my database of available comic book materials, either physical or digital. And that chooses the panel that we're going to look at. We're looking at a single panel. So prior to the recording, we did roll up a year, a month, a comic on the stands that month, a page, and finally a panel. And in this case, we rolled the year 1993, the month of April. Among all the comics out that month, the revolving finger falls on Batman Shadow of the Bat number 13, actual cover date September 1993, by writer Alan Grant and artist Norm Breyfogle, a favorite here at the network. Page 5 of 24, and there are 5 panels on that page. We rolled panel 3, which you'll find in the show notes at fireandwaterpodcast.com. So, Brian, I think the randomizer getting the 90s and then rolling up some Batman there was a good chance there, I think.
Yes.
Were you a Batman fan in this era?
My main experience with Batman around this time was in Grant Morrison's JLA. That's kind of where I really encountered him on a regular basis. From there, I did go into what some may call a Batman phase, depending upon the theory of comic book fandom that you subscribe to. In the later 90s, around the time of No Man's Land, I was collecting Batman titles for a while there, including Shadow of the Bat. But that's obviously few years after this, so I'm not familiar with this particular issue.
Right, this was more my Batman phase, if I ever had one. And then I dropped out about just when you came in, more or less.
Excellent.
So between us, we've got the whole 90s covered. Okay, well, let's describe this panel for the folks, because right now it's very it's vague and abstract. Brian, what can you tell us about just that panel itself?
All right, sure. It's a horizontal panel that stretches kind of diagonally across the page. Setting looks like it's an exterior. You've got the outside wall of a building, lots of windows there. You have, looks like a row of bushes or shrubs growing along the wall. Three main figures in the panel. So starting on the left, you have Batman, who appears to be finishing up a pretty wicked-looking uppercut. In the middle of the panel, you have a man who is flying backwards on his back through the air. And then to the right side of the panel, you have a gentleman who appears to be trying to sleep outside. Fairly disheveled-looking gentleman using newspapers as a blanket. Clearly asleep because his speech bubble is filled with Z's. And then the only other speech balloon in the panel is the gentleman who's flying through the air, giving an "ah" kind of sound. There are two other, I guess, objects in the panel to finish it off. There is a smoking gun flying through the air over Batman's head. And then you have a bottle filled with some beverage, possibly alcoholic, sitting on the ground next to the man who is sleeping.
Well done. And we've also got some nice colors in here I want to mention, because all the figures are sort of in orange, yellow. Gotham's on fire. Gotham is hell. Casting this light. The sky behind Batman is some sort of cranberry. It's always a crisis in Gotham. And then that's a nice contrast to the blue, dark, brown colors of the building, which we don't have context here, but it is a restaurant exterior. Because I do have the comic and I've seen the entire page. I'm sort of cheating. Sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, this is supposed to be, the reason the colors are sort of bizarre is because this is a flashback. Somebody is telling this story, and so they use different colors on it. So there you go. If we look at that shape, let's talk about that shape, because obviously it's non-traditional. In the page layout itself, I mean, it's supposed to be dynamic, and you've got a fight going on. So they're doing, you know, stuff that you weren't seeing in earlier comics, but at this point, yeah, panels are going to be stretched out and angular, and they're going to move with the action. Out of context like this, does it inspire any thoughts?
Yeah, I do think it helps with the kind of just the dynamism, the action that's going on. Especially it draws your eye from the left side of the panel across to the right. And it actually kind of reminds me a bit, having it at an odd angle like that, kind of reminds me a bit of like the old 60s Batman TV show where they, you know, sometimes do that in the fight scenes. So it works for me.
Yeah, in the villain lair, the Dutch angle.
Right.
That's exactly what it, yeah. And it's also got a strange shape because there's like a panel, the bottom panel is sort of intruding at an angle. So it creates a, I don't know, is it a gun, a cleaver shape? Or, you know, it's almost be some sort of knife or a blade, razor blade kind of shape in a way if we take it out of context like this, which fits the Batman for sure. Some interesting things about this for me is, here's how I called the goon in the middle, the guy getting punched. I called him young Lex Luthor.
I could see that.
From the Superboy days. It's kind of, and I think the motion that you were describing, it helps the eye move the story forward, but it also kind of, because of those shrubs, those poplar-like little trees look like spikes, and the bottle is a spike. And it almost feels like young Lex Luthor is falling back onto a bed of spikes in a way. You know, if we crush the image, if we don't see the perspective. So it adds to the sort of danger that is created there.
Yeah, at least kind of my read on it. I mean, your eye's definitely drawn to that gentleman, that guy who's flying through the air, the goon. He seems to be, I don't know, I guess almost more in focus, particularly looking at his face, like the details seem much sharper than Batman or the man who's sleeping against the building. They seem a little bit, you know, it's kind of sketchier in the way they're drawn. And so, yeah, I can definitely see that in the composition. Yeah,
I think it's a good point because you've got the, let's call the other guy the bum. Yeah, the homeless man, his knees are like little spirals, which is very cartoony. As a detail, it's sort of in contrast to the more solid figure of Lex flying off, and like it with a distorted body where he's being knocked out and his limbs are flailing. But I think Adrienne Roy's coloring here is particularly on point because she puts the brighter flame on his face, which really makes that the middle of the panel and the middle of the what you're looking at, you know, for sure.
As I said, it's interesting looking at the bum on the street, because I was trying to figure out, yeah, if those were his knees, or I was wondering if those were actually his shoes, the bottoms of his shoes.
No, I think you're right. That's like scuffed shoes underneath, like holes right in his shoes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And so there's a real foreshortening here where, yeah, I was seeing, I guess his knees would have been really low on the body if I were right. But I like how he's sleeping basically on the floor of the panel, like the panel is the ground and he's right on it. Like our camera viewpoint is not above the ground at all when we're looking at him.
We're right at his level, kind of looking up at the action kind of occurring above him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Another thing that kind of jumped out at me when I was taking a closer look to it is kind of looking at the, you know, the goon flying through the air juxtaposed with the guy sleeping there on the ground, is you almost get this kind of like a yin yang kind of symbol there. And then that even kind of imagery kind of even fits with what's going on. So you have the one guy flying through the air in motion and the other one
right
basically comatose there on the ground, which is kind of an interesting contrast.
I'm surprised that the bottle seems to have liquid in it.
Yes. It's certainly not full.
No, but it may be a red wine bottle. The red wine bottles are already dark to protect the liquid. So it would just be an empty bottle, but just dark. You know, this guy wouldn't let a full bottle
just sit there
while he sleeps. And he's really snoring it up because, like I mentioned, Adrienne Roy as the colorist here, but letterer Todd Klein is also doing a bit of business because the Z's are bursting out of that bubble. They're really thick letters. So you really believe he's well asleep, because if that's a smoking gun, there has just been a gunshot.
Yes.
So he's really out of it. Which is surprising in context of the story, is that he's telling the story. This is his memory. So I'm not sure he's telling the truth.
This could be what he was dreaming of while he was sleeping.
Right. It's certainly a vague memory because, I mean, that could explain why Batman is, his face is totally in shadow. You know, you don't get a sense that he saw Batman very well, you know, in his memory. So that, I think that fits. I like the whole blanket made of newspapers. It's a nice detail. I am disappointed that it doesn't have a cool headline on it.
Yeah, I was trying to take a close look to see if there's any, but yeah, other than it says Gotham News on it, and other than that, it's just all...
Yes.
Just, yeah, there's not actually anything else.
No, it's kind of boring. Gotham News, is that even one of the newspapers we hear a lot about? Doesn't Vicki Vale work for the Gazette or Gotham Gazette? I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm weak on my Batman lore, my Batman journalism lore. I'm sorry. I mean, this is a Norm Breyfogle panel. And I kind of think that I could have picked anything. Obviously, it's a random panel, but you know, the randomizer could have given us any panel from this issue, and I think it would have been interesting. I think Norm Breyfogle is, you know, one of the great Batman artists, and it shows here because in this strange shaped panel, there's a composition, there's movement, there's action, there's details, there's some amusing elements, you know, there's a bit of everything in here.
Yes, yeah, I agree. And I have to admit that I'm largely still learning my comic book artist. So I'm not the guy who can, look at a panel like this and tell you who drew it. But, you know, I am, thanks to the effort of Chris and Ryan over on Nightcast, I am slowly learning my Batman artist. So
you make a good point because, you know, I can spot which artist is which, but describing the style can sometimes eludes me. My visual arts training is very far behind me, and it was just a lark at the time. It was just like side courses that I used to take. So I know a bit about composition. I can speak to that. But when it comes to like describing the line or knowing what kind of tools were used, you know, I kind of have to defer to Rob Kelly or somebody who has like actual training in the arts.
Yeah.
Any last thoughts on this one panel from Shadow of the Bat?
I guess the one other thing I have to point out that jumped out at me is the ears on Batman's cowl are, they're definitely there. You can't miss them.
They're Breyfogle. You know, they're thin, but they're long. And they sort of curve a little bit. He's making it look like horns.
Yeah.
Yeah. Horns, antenna, you know, something like that. He was really good, I think, at making Batman not quite as, you know, there are some artists that make, like, the cape is insane or, you know, try to make him more animalistic. And it, you can really tell it's an expressionistic kind of look where that's not real. That's just how the bad guys see it or something. So I think Breyfogle brought a bit of that, but still kept a kind of solid human figure in there. So yeah, I like it too. I like that those, like the ears are spikes. His left hand is also kind of spiky, black spiky. And then you got the spikes on the glove from his right hand where he's doing that uppercut.
So, yeah.
You know, he's a prickly figure. Whereas the others are, there is no black on the others. You know, they're dressed in light clothing or covered in light newspapers, have light hair or no hair. So he's really kept the blackness, the dark, I'm the knight. That
where
one figure.
Where it belongs. Where it belongs.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, you know, I think we've covered it pretty well. I hope you had fun, Brian, with this short, but these are short episodes, but it kind of breaks the ice. I hope you had fun.
Oh, I did. It's a memory I'll cherish forever, I'm sure.
Well, it'll be on record, so you can listen to it.
Yeah.
So I'll let you go back to the margins, and we'll listen to a short promo. I'll come back with listener feedback on our previous episode.
So which is the hottest Marvel character?
Iron Man.
Ant-Man. I can't decide between Professor X and Magneto, so both.
Loki.
Is Wolverine Marvel?
What about White Tiger?
What about White Tiger?
Doc Samson.
Who?
Star Fox.
That's a video game.
The girls go on a journey to determine every Marvel character's hotness in Ohatmu or Not, the official handbook of the Marvel Universe podcast you didn't know you wanted. Available on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Our previous episode discussed a panel from Fantastic Four number 1 with guest Andrew Leyland. Here's your feedback, comment by comment. Now, Benjamin Kellogg did his own analysis of the panel. Very interesting stuff. He also says, I do hope you continue breaking the issue down. That image of our transformed hero's hands coming in for the pledge to a new team, Ben's rocky digits joining at the last second, are the ultimate Little League good game gesture. No plans to keep covering that same issue as a randomizer. Much too fickle for that. Episodes of Panel by Panel have spanned more than 100 years, multiple publishers, and even several countries. So hopefully you can find your joy in other episodes and the variety that Panel by Panel trades in. Chris Franklin says, great discussion and a great panel to discuss. I think this is all interesting because some historians contend that Kirby's art in FF number 1 is rather crude for his output at the time. Jack Kirby Collector number 58, Lee and Kirby The Wonder Years, postulates Kirby's art in Amazing Adventures number 6, which came out the same month, also from Atlas Marvel, was far superior in design and execution. So despite its seminal importance, FF number 1 is not even the best example of Kirby's art from the period to be enlarged. Captain Entropy says, I think you saw everything that was in the panel, and I think you avoided making up anything for which there was no evidence. That made your discussion both satisfying and informative. Also, excellent American accent by Andy on the dialogue. I looked up cosmic rays on Wikipedia because I remembered from school they really could go through shielding more than other types of radiation. Turns out the rays thing is a misnomer. They're really high-energy subatomic particles and even some heavier nuclei. They come from the sun and from elsewhere in the Milky Way galaxy. The highest energy particles even come from outside our galaxy, possibly from supernovae. The Earth's magnetic field deflects a lot of them, so they really are an issue for astronauts. They're especially a concern for potential manned missions to Mars. The damage cosmic rays do to our cells may be far more mundane, but there's no evidence of them giving anyone fantastic powers. But otherwise, Stan and Jack were pretty spot on. Stan always criticized his own scientific ignorance. I found the counter-evidence refreshing. Ange had this to say, says, glad to see the show brought back and definitely love the conversation here, the perfect panel for the randomizer to pick. For me, for a company to put out such a book, the comic either needs to be of significant importance or the art needs to be worthy. I could see me musing over purchasing a panel by panel Bernie Wrightson book or Brian Boland book or even John Totleben book, maybe Barry Windsor Smith, but the art needs to hold up to such scrutiny. And Martin Gray says he's chuffed to bits to have this show back. Says, I feared the last guest had killed it. He means himself. What a fun panel and what a great guest. I had, perhaps still have, but I think it went to a charity shop, the Maximum FF book. It was a fun curio, but not something that works. Lee and Kirby were creating drive-by comics, not trying for masterworks to be studied. Andrew pointed out some of the problems with the book project. I doubt even the supposedly superior Amazing Adventures number 6 would yield much more worth talking about. I don't have the trained eyes of Kirby collectors, but I don't see the quality as being so different. I like this panel a lot, but its true value is in its context and legacy, as you pointed out. I have to say the colorists were pretty work-shy back then. You might argue the toss and say all the pink and red is to create a mood, but check out any of those earlier Marvel books, and pretty much every panel is monochrome. I actually really like it, and I love word balloons that have been colored in. They're so cheery. Well, if you like this content, please think about making a one-time or monthly donation to Fire & Water's Patreon page at patreon.com/fwpodcasts. And as ever, a reminder, if you'd like to do one of these short podcasts, drop me a line and we'll arrange it. You will be handed a comic book panel randomly and we'll put it up for discussion. So my thanks again to my guest, Brian Linton, who did just that. And until we refill that seat, the panel is open.